Imagine, just for a second, that you got called into your boss's office today.
Oh, man.
Right? You sit down, the door clicks shut behind you, and they slide a piece of paper across the desk.
The dream scenario.
Totally. You look down, and it is this massive life-changing raise. Like your salary just literally doubled.
Wow.
Yeah, so you walk out of that office feeling like you are on top of the world. You are finally undeniably wealthy.
Right.
Well, hold on. I mean, does a bigger paycheck actually make you wealthy? Or does it just give you the ability to buy, more expensive things while staying exactly where you are on the financial chessboard?
It is a well, it's a phenomenal question to start with, because that exact confusion, equating a high income with actual wealth, that is exactly what traps so many people.
Yeah.
We just intuitively assume the two are identical. But structurally, mathematically, I mean, they are entirely different things.
And that is exactly our mission today. We are diving into a July 2026 compilation of research called The Wealth Gap. It was published jointly by the American newspaper and American TV. And the goal of this deep dive is to completely strip away the moral judgments, the societal stereotypes, and all that heavy, messy emotion we usually tie to money.
Exactly. Because it gets so emotional.
It really does. So we want to look at wealth purely as a structural balance sheet condition for you.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Right.
How do we actually define wealth if it is not just pulling in a huge salary?
Right. So we have to set a completely cold analytical baseline here. Wealth is not a moral ranking of who works the hardest,
No.
and it's not some badge of honor for who is the smartest either. It is simply a mathematical formula. It involves assets, liquidity, and time.
Okay, so just math.
Just math. Specifically, true wealth is defined as the degree to which you control productive assets, you maintain positive and resilient cash flow, and this is key, you can absorb major financial shocks without resorting to ruinous borrowing.
Right, the borrowing trap.
Yeah. Most importantly, true wealth gives you meaningful freedom over your time, your location, and your work. Okay, so we really have to sever this mental link between income and net worth, because like income is just a flow.
Yes, a flow.
But net worth is a stock. It's a reservoir. And to bring this to life, there is a super stark contrast in the data we looked at from the report.
Oh, the doctor and the plumber.
Yes. Picture a highly specialized physician earning $450,000 a year.
Which sounds amazing.
Right. On paper, that flow of money is incredible. But let's look at their actual balance sheet. They are drowning in $300,000 of medical school debt.
Dowry.
They've taken on a massive mortgage for, a doctor tier house, plus private school tuition for the kids, and just generally massive fixed lifestyle costs.
Right.
So if that doctor gets sick or just wants to stop working for a month, the whole system immediately crashes.
Exactly. The flow stops and those obligations immediately sink them. Now, you contrast that physician with the owner of a local, unglamorous plumbing company.
Yeah.
This owner pays themselves a taxable salary of maybe $140,000 a year.
Which is a fraction of what the doctor makes.
Total fraction.
Yeah.
But here's the structural difference.
Yeah.
This plumber owns a debt-light business valued at $1.5 million.
Wow.
They own the commercial building where their trucks park, free and clear. They have a diversified retirement portfolio built up over 20 years.
That's the stock.
Exactly. The physician has a much higher labor income, but the plumbing company owner has far more asset-based security. They have optionality,
Yeah.
They can hire a manager, step away for a year, and the system still generates value.
The macroeconomic data backing this up is just wild, too. When you look at the Federal Reserve's 2022 survey of consumer finances,
Yeah, those numbers are striking.
they really are. The median family net worth was $192,900.
Okay.
But if you drill down into the bottom quartile, their median net worth was just $3,500.
Wow.
Think about that. $3,500. That means a single blown transmission on your car basically wipes out everything you own. Meanwhile, the top decile's median was 3.79 million.
Which is a massive gap.
And it gets even more concentrated. By the 2026 Q1 update in the report, the top 10% holds about 68% of all household wealth, while the bottom 50% holds just about 2.5%.
I mean, those numbers just represent a fundamental reality about how money behaves once it begins to accumulate. Money is magnetic.
Magnetic,
When
yeah.
you have financial margin, like when you aren't spending literally everything you earn just to survive, you can buy equities, housing, businesses, intellectual property,
Right.
and those assets produce autonomous returns that you can then reinvest.
It makes me think of an analogy. Earning a high income without actively building assets is like running on a treadmill.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
Right. You can run incredibly fast. You can burn a ton of calories. You can look highly successful doing it. But the second you stop moving your legs, you fall off.
Yep, you're done.
Wealth, on the other hand, is the solid floor beneath the treadmill. But let me challenge you on this for a second. If the top 10% owns 68% of the wealth, isn't the whole game just about getting a high-paying job as fast as possible? Doesn't the speed of the treadmill matter most?
Well, what's fascinating here is that labor income is usually just step one. Yes, you need a shovel to start digging, and a high-paying job is a spectacularly big shovel.
A very nice shovel.
Exactly. Wages finance your food, your housing, and most importantly, your first unit of savings. But the structural weakness of labor income is exactly what you just pointed out. It stops the second your legs stop moving.
Right.
True wealth only occurs when you manage to convert your labor into claims that produce value after you clock out.
I see.
If income is the treadmill, wealth is using your time on the treadmill to build a generator that eventually powers the machine for you.
That's a great image.
Yeah, we're talking about converting your daily sweat into public equities, real estate, IP, or business ownership.
Okay, so wealth acts as this protective floor, this generator that runs in the background, which brings us to a really difficult but absolutely necessary part of the research. Yes.
We need to examine what happens to decision-making when that floor is entirely missing. Like what happens when you are running on the treadmill, but there's a cliff right behind you?
It changes everything.
This is what the report calls the scarcity feedback loop.
Right. The scarcity feedback loop shows us that having extremely low resources fundamentally alters your cognitive capacity to make future-oriented investments.
How so?
It changes the actual mathematical decision problem in front of you. When you are operating in scarcity, your immediate bills and crises dominate all of your attention.
Right, because you're just trying to survive the day.
Exactly. The future benefits of investing, or even just saving, are mathematically unaffordable today because today's survival is not guaranteed.
And this leads to this concept of the poverty premium. Basically, it literally costs more money to be poor.
It really does.
And think about the mechanics of it. You are buying groceries in smaller, more expensive packages because you literally do not have the liquidity to afford the bulk price, even though the bulk price is cheaper per ounce. Right, you can't tie up $20 in paper towels.
Exactly. You have higher transport costs because you can't afford a reliable car, so you are relying on patchwork solutions like ride shares or really expensive repairs on a lemon. You are hit with late fees, overdraft fees, higher security deposits.
It compounds in the wrong direction.
It totally does. But the most jaw-dropping statistic to me in the report is the mechanics of payday loans.
Oh, yeah. That math is brutal.
A typical payday loan fee is $15 per $100 borrowed for two rents.
Right.
Now, people hear $15 and think, oh, that's just the price of a burger, no big deal.
Sure.
But when you annualize that, when you actually look at the math, it translates to an annual percentage rate of nearly 400%.
400%.
Yeah.
And we have to combine that brutal math with the 2025 Federal Reserve Survey on emergency funds.
Okay, what did that one say?
That survey found that 75% of adults making over $100,000 a year had a comfortable three-month cash reserve.
Right, which makes sense.
But for those making under $25,000, only 21% had that buffer.
Oh, wow. Only 21%.
Yeah. That means when a crisis hits, and, you know, crises always hit, the vast majority of low-income households have absolutely no choice but to rely on expensive, predatory debt just to survive the week.
Wait, I really want to push back on this a bit because it is something you hear constantly in personal finance spaces.
Go for it.
When someone takes out a 400% APR loan to fix their car instead of, I don't know, tightly budgeting and putting that money into an index fund, isn't that just irrational budgeting? Like, shouldn't they just exhibit more self-control and make a better financial choice?
It looks deeply irrational from the outside. I mean, of course it does. But structurally, risk aversion and poverty is entirely rational.
Really? How?
Let's look at the mechanics. If a household has a net worth of $5 million, they can easily risk $25,000 on a speculative new business idea.
Right. Pocket change.
Right. If it completely fails and goes to zero, their housing and food are perfectly safe. But if a household only has $500 to their name, they cannot risk $250. Even if the expected return is mathematically brilliant.
Because it's half their net worth.
Because losing that $250 threatens their basic physical survival. When rent is due tomorrow, and your car needs a repair today so you don't get fired from your only job.
Right, the stakes are so much higher.
The choice isn't between a payday loan and a Vanguard index fund. The choice is between expensive debt and immediate ruin.
Wow.
So a short-term choice that will technically bankrupt you over the course of a year can be entirely logically rational if it is the absolute only physical way to survive the next 48 hours.
That makes total sense when you break down the actual choices in front of them. And since poverty is often this structural trap rather than just a series of quote-unquote bad choices, it logically follows that wealth isn't purely the result of superior personal virtue either. The data in this report completely dismantles two massive stereotypes.
Yeah, the two big ones.
The idea that the wealthy are inherently wise and the poor are inherently lazy.
Survivorship bias plays a massive, often completely unacknowledged role here.
Tell me about that.
We see the entrepreneur who succeeded, who made millions, and we just assume it was purely their unparalleled genius and work ethic.
Right, they're just built different.
Exactly. What we don't see is the equally hardworking, equally brilliant entrepreneur who failed because of bad macroeconomic timing, or an unexpected health crisis, or simply a lack of a familial financial safety net.
Yeah, the invisible advantages.
Market cycles, luck, and timing distribute rewards in ways that frequently have absolutely nothing to do with moral character. Conversely, many low-income people work multiple jobs, they provide extensive unpaid caregiving, and they navigate brutal, unstable schedules.
So working incredibly hard.
Their actual labor effort is incredibly high, but their market compensation is low because of structural factors like employer concentration and a complete lack of bargaining power.
Now, if we strip away all the political rhetoric that usually surrounds this topic and just look mathematically at the historical balance sheets, the structural data on race and historical accumulation is incredibly clear here.
It really is.
For example, 2021 Census Bureau estimates showed median wealth for households with a white householder at $250,400, compared to median wealth for households with a black householder at just $24,520.
When you look at the math, these statistics are actually the result of cumulative history.
Yeah, just looking at the timeline.
Right. We're tracing the generational compounding effects of exclusion from property markets, unequal schooling, occupational segregation, and differences in exposure to caregiving and health risks.
Because it snowballs.
Exactly. Wealth gaps widen over time because of the fundamental nature of compounding interest. So early historical disparities in housing access or institutional access, they don't just stay static. They compound exponentially over decades.
And that brings us to the true nature of inheritance, which I think is heavily misunderstood.
Very much so.
Inheritance isn't just a rich uncle suddenly leaving you $1 million in his will when you turn 50. That's like a movie trope.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Real inheritance operates much earlier and much more subtly, and it changes the math of your entire life.
Like what?
It is childhood housing stability, meaning you didn't have to change schools four times. It is parents paying for college, so you graduate without a $1,000 a month student loan payment.
Right.
It is the ability to take a prestigious unpaid internship in a high-value industry in a major city because your family covers your rent.
Wow, yeah.
And most importantly, it is the silent safety net that guarantees if your first bold business experiment fails, you won't end up on the street.
It is exactly like playing a video game.
Oh, I like this.
Right. So one player has endless extra lives. They can test out bold, highly risky strategies, run straight at the boss, fail completely, and just respawn back at the checkpoint and try again with new knowledge.
Right.
The other player is playing on hardcore mode. They have exactly one life. A single mistake, one bad jump, one stroke of bad macroeconomic luck, and it is game over. You get sent all the way back to the start screen. You are going to play those two games entirely differently.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it explains exactly why the wealthy appear so much bolder and more innovative.
Or they can afford to be.
Yes. They can afford the repeated failures that are required to eventually find massive success.
Mm.
Their downside is fundamentally capped. For a vulnerable household, the downside is infinite.
Okay, so we've mapped out the structural headwinds, the myths, and the realities. But, you know, understanding the theory doesn't pay your bills.
Unfortunately not.
Right. So how does a listener actually apply this? The source material doesn't just diagnose the problem, which I love. It provides an actionable, sequential progression to move from economic vulnerability to true ownership.
Yes, the ladder.
It's an 8-step ladder. And the absolute primary rule here is that skipping steps is economically self-defeating.
You cannot leapfrog the math.
Yeah.
You just can't. You cannot aggressively invest in a tech startup if you are carrying a 25% interest rate on a credit card.
Mm.
Or if you don't have the cash to cover a broken water heater.
It just doesn't work.
No. The sequence must be cumulative to build a resilient balance sheet.
Okay, let's walk through how this actually works. Phase one, covering steps one and two, is about stabilizing the foundation.
Right.
Step one is increasing your reliable income or cutting fixed costs to create a 5 to 20% monthly surplus. Remember the treadmill. You have to have a shovel and you need extra dirt.
You gotta have the dirt.
Step two is building the emergency fund. But I love the psychology here in the report. They don't say save 6 months of expenses immediately because that is just paralyzing for most people.
Yeah, that's way too daunting.
They say, start with a $500 buffer. Just get $500 in cash. Why? Because $500 stops a blown tire from becoming a predatory 400% APR payday loan.
Exactly.
It turns a crisis into an inconvenience. Once you have that, then you aim for the 3 to 6 months.
Exactly. It's all about stopping the bleeding first.
Yeah.
Once that buffer is in place, you move to phase two, which is steps three and four. This is about defense.
Okay, defense.
Step three is eliminating high interest debt.
Mm.
Mathematically, you should use the avalanche method, which is targeting the highest interest rate first because that kills the negative compounding fastest.
Right.
But psychologically, the snowball method, paying off the smallest balance first, is totally valid because it gives you the dopamine hit and the momentum you need to keep going.
Whatever gets you there.
Exactly. Then step four is obtaining appropriate insurance. And the fundamental guidance here is brilliant. You buy insurance to protect against ruin, not just inconvenience.
Oh, that's a huge distinction.
Right. You don't need the extended warranty on a $40 toaster, but you absolutely need term life insurance if you have dependents. You need disability insurance, and you need liability insurance to protect your balance sheet from catastrophic wiping out events.
Right. Defense before offense. Then we cross the bridge to phase three, offense. Steps five and six.
This is the fun part.
Step five is making long-term investments. This starts with capturing your employer match, which is literally free money, you know, 100% immediate return, and consistently buying diversified low-cost funds.
Yep.
Step six is where true wealth is built. Acquiring business and equity ownership, moving from just selling your time for a wage to owning a claim on future cash flows.
And, you know, if we connect this to the bigger picture, I look at step six, acquire business and equity ownership. And I know exactly what a lot of people are thinking.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Right.
Because I was thinking, do I have to start a business? Do I have to become a landlord to be wealthy? Because honestly, managing tenants at 2 a.m. or dealing with payroll and inventory just sounds like a total nightmare to a lot of people.
The research explicitly provides counterexamples for this exact worry. Risk-taking does not automatically equal wealth. And homeownership or small business ownership isn't universally superior, especially if it creates hidden concentration risk.
What do you mean by concentration risk?
Think about it. If all your net worth is tied up in one local restaurant and your primary house is in that same town, one regional economic downturn wipes out your income and your asset base simultaneously.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you're totally exposed.
You don't need to be an entrepreneur. Diversified public equities, just consistently buying broad index funds in your retirement accounts, is fractional ownership of the world's most profitable companies.
So you're still an owner?
Yes. It is a perfectly valid, historically proven path to joining the asset-owning class without ever managing a single employee.
That is incredibly relieving. So you can be an owner just by holding the index. Which brings us to the final phase, optimization. Step seven and eight.
Finishing touches.
Step seven is managing taxes legally and efficiently. Because it doesn't matter what you make, it matters what you keep. How does someone actually do that?
It basically comes down to understanding the structural advantages built into the tax code. It means using tax-sheltered accounts like 401ks and IRAs to let your money compound without the drag of annual taxes.
Right.
If you do own real estate, it means understanding depreciation. And fundamentally, it means recognizing that the tax code heavily favors long-term capital gains, the profit from holding an asset for over a year, far more than it favors ordinary labor income.
And finally, step eight is building strong networks, which I'll admit sounds like corporate buzzword bingo, but the mechanics of it are actually fascinating. Networks are crucial economic infrastructure because they lower what economists call the cost of trust.
Exactly. When you're trying to find a new client, or an investor, or a key hire, dealing with strangers requires immense mental energy and risk.
Yeah, it's exhausting.
A strong network bypasses that.
Mm.
A warm introduction transfers trust. It provides early access to information and credible referrals. You build this not by handing out business cards, but by consistently providing reciprocal value in your specific industry over a long period of time.
So what does this all mean? When we pull all of this together, the separation of income and wealth, the structural traps of scarcity, the reality of compounding, and this phased ladder to ownership, the ultimate goal of this deep dive isn't just to teach you how to accumulate a massive pile of money so you can buy visible luxury.
No.
The goal is freedom of choice.
That is the perfect distillation. Economic security is a capacity. It is the practical, lived capacity to look a toxic boss in the eye and walk away.
Yes.
It is the ability to take 6 months off to care for a sick parent without wondering how you will buy groceries. It is the power to retrain for a completely new career or to simply wait out a brutal macroeconomic recession for a better opportunity without facing eviction.
Which is huge.
That is what true wealth buys you. It buys you your autonomy.
I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, something that builds on the realities of this data.
Let's hear it.
We are seeing right now that intellectual property and platform dependence are creating massive winner-take-most markets. We are moving further and further into a gig-based, AI-driven economy where traditional labor income, the classic 9-to-5 paycheck, is becoming fractured, algorithm-driven, and highly unstable.
It really is shifting fast.
It is. As this transition accelerates, how will you ensure that you are building tangible equity and ownership? How will you make sure you aren't just endlessly renting out your time and your labor to someone else's platform, completely at the mercy of their algorithm?
It is the defining economic question of our era. If you are only ever paid for the hours you currently supply, you remain structurally vulnerable. The imperative for everyone listening is to find a way, however small at first, to own the system, or at least a fractional share of it.
Which brings us right back to that massive raise we imagined at the start of our conversation. That raise is incredible, and you should celebrate it. But remember, it just speeds up the treadmill. Your job now, armed with an understanding of the mechanics we've unpacked today, is to use that speed to build a solid, permanent floor beneath you. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Take a hard look at your own balance sheet this week through this new lens, and we will see you next time.